CliffCentral.com.
The Boating Platform is brought to you by Nando's. Every week we try to check in on the most important stories that could affect you, that might interest you, and that you might want to have some clarity on. So we try to get to the bare bones of what's actually happening. And on the line with us this morning is returning champion Ivo Fechter. So Ivo, another great article. I know that you have been in South Africa. There are very few people who report honestly and truthfully and factually about environmental issues. You often get into trouble for doing this because some people don't like the truth. They just want the hysteria, the emotion, the anxiety, the alarmism. Are you sometimes at odds with your own community in terms of writing about the environment and caring about the environment and having a different method for sorting out some of our problems? And do you often find that there are people who should be on your side who are ideologically opposed to you just because of the means of getting to the same end?
Yeah, I think that's a big problem. People think that I'm anti-environment, or, you know, on other issues they will say, oh, but, you know, I'm a shill for fossil fuels, or the other day I was told I support big tobacco. It's people get very polarized about these things, and if you don't agree with their sort of very socialist sort of government control kind of model of improving the world, then they sort of cast you into a box right on the opposite side. One of them called me a white supremacist the other day because I support capitalism.
So let's just be clear, you are not funded by the fossil fuel industry, you're not funded by big tobacco, none of these people are secretly making payments to you and using you as some kind of public lobbyist, right?
I wish. If they were, I'd be talking to you from my yacht right now.
Yeah. All right, so why do you think we have such a disparity between people on the left and people in the center about how to deal with environmental issues?
Well, I think it actually goes back to what I said in my column is socialism. You know, the best idea these days, or the central idea these days, is this Green New Deal that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the U.S. Champions, and several other people both in Europe and in the U.S. They say, oh, we want a new Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. But if you look at that Green New Deal, I mean, it's not just about sort of green energy and so on, which is, frankly, it's also a large vested interest.
Yes.
It's a very profitable business, green energy and green technology. But it goes much further. You know, it goes towards guaranteeing jobs to everyone, guaranteeing everyone, paid leave, paid vacations, retirement security. It goes to labor unions. It's really a socialist sort of blueprint for running the world. And I think that's where the fundamental difference lies, is in how you approach these problems and how you think politically you're going to be able to solve them.
Well, I heard an argument on Real Time with Bill Maher last week where someone shouted down one of the guys and he said, look, the free market can sort out more of the environmental problems than any amount of government could. And this person on the panel who didn't say that, who was clearly opposed to it, stood up and said, are you saying the free market can take care of this? Nonsense. But could it?
Well, it does. You know, it's not a matter of could it. It's not a theory. I looked at this and I said, okay, well, let's go to the actual data.
Yeah.
So I drew a bunch of plots and said, okay, let's look at per capita GDP versus environmental performance. And there's an environmental performance index which looks at something like 24 different environmental criteria.
Yeah.
And ranks countries on that. And if you draw that, it is a very, very clear correlation that higher per capita GDP is correlated with a higher environmental performance. The richest country in the world the second richest country in the world is Switzerland.
Yeah.
Right? Which has the very highest environmental performance index in the world. So then I looked at economic freedom. If you look at the Fraser Institute, they publish this annual Economic Freedom of the World index, which is really a great document. It looks at economic freedom through various, a lot of measures in five different categories, from the size of the state to taxation to sound monetary policy and so policy and so on. And again, you get exactly the right correlation. You get the higher economic freedom means better environmental performance. Switzerland is once again a standout. It's the third freest economy in the world, and it has the single highest environmental performance index.
Well, what, is there any argument against this position? Are there other reports? Are there UN documents that would make a case for the other side?
Well, not that I've seen. You know, I mean, I thought, okay, well, then some people say, yeah, no, that's all very fine, but what about carbon emissions? You know, because they associate capitalist economies with carbon pollution, and they say they externalize this carbon pollution. So I looked at the carbon intensity, which is basically a measure of how much CO2 is produced per dollar of GDP. Right, so this is, if you measure it any other way, you're going to get very different results depending on population size and how wealthy a country is. Mm-hmm. But if you measure carbon intensity and you plot that against economic freedom, again, you get a correlation. You know, and if you look at the United States, for example, right, it has an economic freedom score of 8.19. It's ranked fifth in the world on economic freedom. Okay. It has a carbon intensity of 0.25. Now, China is ranked 113th in the world, right? So much, much worse than the United States in terms of economic freedom.
Right.
Its carbon intensity is 0.8, which is more than three times as much as the carbon intensity of the United States. So they produce more CO2 per dollar of GDP produced.
Right.
This just shows that.
But Ivo, correspondingly, yes, as the GDP of China increases, without the emissions necessarily decreasing at all, that ratio is going to decrease as well. And, you know, China's GDP, we can talk about whether China fudges its GDP figures, which I think it does to some extent. But is that really a fair measure for us to be using? I mean, surely per capita would probably make a bit more sense.
Well, per capita, but then you don't take into account whether or not people are actually have the living standards that they really require. You know, I mean, per capita, one of the best in terms of carbon intensity countries, in fact, the second best, I think, is Mali.
Oh, really?
You know, now do you really want an economy like that of Mali, where there's basically no industrialization? Right, so there's no production, so they don't produce any CO2, but they've got nothing either. You know, they're a dirt poor country. Well, you don't want a dirt poor country. You want people to have long life expectancy, low child mortality, basically good standards of living, good health care and so on, good water and sanitation.
But you're absolutely right. We see this correlation with prosperity and other things at so many levels. I mean, one of the bugbears that people keep coming up with is the rise in population in poorer countries, particularly on the African continent. Mm-hmm. And you'll find that there's this distinct correlation that as soon as people become wealthier, they start having fewer kids.
And they start caring more about the environment.
Yes, and so there's a direct correlation between prosperity and your ability to then focus on things that are actually not directly related to growing your family. I mean, for lots of people in our country right now, particularly older generations, having a number of kids is effectively a pension plan.
Yes, and that makes sense. I mean, if you are poorer, then it actually makes sense to have more children, partially because if you're poorer, your child mortality is generally higher. Right? Yeah. So, you know, rich people tend to assume that the children they have are going to survive until they're 20, and then maybe kill themselves in a drunk driving accident. Who knows? But when you're poorer, it's a challenge to actually get to five, to get to where you're secure. So your child mortality is highest. People have more children, and then you're right, because they can't save for retirement, and there's no sort of retirement plan for them. They use their children, because especially in a country like ours with high unemployment, if you have a number of children, only one or two of them might end up with jobs, might end up earning income. And they earn the income for the entire extended family. So it's absolutely an insurance policy from that perspective.
I had
as people get richer, that's not necessary. So yeah. People have far fewer children. Kids become an expense rather than an economic benefit.
Which is why Sia currently has only how many kids?
No, proudly zero.
Ivo, just on a related matter, I had an interesting conversation which we will put out as a podcast later this week with Peter Boghossian, who's an interesting academic from Portland. And we were talking a little bit about how this environmentalism has replaced, for a lot of wealthy elites in the developed world, it has replaced religion in some respect, because there seems to be a fanaticism about it, which you know, they often accuse people of being climate deniers or of avoiding the scientific consensus in order to proffer their own bizarre ideas about the environment on the other side. But it seems to me that there is this religious element, this zealotry around climate, which has absorbed a large proportion of the very wealthy and you know, that's a super connected. It's a way almost for them to assuage their guilt over having more than everyone else. Do you feel that there's some merit in that argument? Because it seems to me that's all that's happening on the east and west coast of America at the moment, is climate religion.
Yeah, you know, the late Michael Crichton, you know, a great author, he actually came up with this idea. I think he came up with it back in the 90s. He said environmentalism is sort of the new secular religion.
Yeah.
Right? And it's people seek meaning in their lives. They, you know, the whole, you know, I mean, I'm an atheist and I don't believe in this sort of stuff. But if you look at why people believe in religions and so on, they do feel a sense of guilt. They do. They feel that they need something bigger than themselves. And if you look at environmentalism, in a more secular world where people are not necessarily religious, they tend to cling to that. And the parallels are really quite remarkable. You know, there's the original sin of you know, getting rich and polluting the environment and producing CO2 and so on. And then there's you know, this forgiveness if you do good deeds, like, you know, you buy low carbon products, or you cut down on plastics or whatever. There's a great deal of parallels between your classic sort of Catholic guilt based religion and environmentalism.
Yeah, it's just fascinating to me that the two seem to go hand in hand in so many respects, and yet the means of dealing with it doesn't seem to be completely sorted out yet. We're not entirely sure of whether or not we've made the right moves in the right direction and whether we're making a difference.
I'm suddenly thinking about the carbon footprint of communion wafers.
Yes. No, I mean, the other parallel is obviously what you mentioned about critics. You know, they don't look at critics as people who are intellectually honest and have sort of have a bona fide interest in improving what we know and understand about the environment and how to improve it. They look at critics as heretics and as evil.
Yeah.
And by painting them up as evil and calling them denialist after the sort of Holocaust denial model, that's how they actually silence the criticism and manage to carry on with their belief or their blind faith without it ever really being challenged.
All right, well, let's just talk quickly about another article you've written, Why Socialism Thrives Nowhere Except at Universities, and then we can move into some serious current affairs stuff. You talk about universities, and you're quite glib about what they're doing and how it's almost like an indoctrination process, and why this idea has somehow survived, what, two centuries now, but it's only survived because academics coddle it. And why do you think that is? And where in South Africa do you think the biggest culprits are?
I think they're everywhere in universities at the moment. Look, specifically in the arts and humanities departments. And look, it's always been this way. You know, it was certainly that way when I was at university. You know, I was in the science department and we didn't really care much about politics. The commerce department, which was on a different campus, they certainly didn't care much about left-wing politics, but the humanities, the BA students, right, they were all about socialism and Marxism and Marxist thought. You know, so it's you know, it's really interesting. I mean, I based it on an article that Johan Fourier wrote for Rapport, who said he spoke about economics and capitalism to a bunch of journalism students at Stellenbosch University. Mm-hmm. You know, and all of them kind of said that, oh, well, capitalism is a system that exploits people and impoverishes them and it takes away their freedoms. And he had to sort of sit back a bit and say, well, hang on a second, you know, this has led to the biggest rise in prosperity over the last two centuries. You know, private property rights, democracy, press freedom, free markets, they're all associated with capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know, extreme poverty has declined from 44% of the world's population to less than 10% in the last 40 years. And that's because of the spread of economic freedoms, because of the spread of capitalism. And the students were surprised. They said, why has nobody ever taught us this view? It goes back a long way. You know, it goes back to probably the 30s, and certainly after the war in the 50s and 60s, that universities ended up with a lot of professors who held these socialist ideas.
But isn't it a professor's job to bring empirical evidence to bear and to show students how to interpret all this empirical evidence and use it to figure out how the world really works? Why are they doing the exact opposite here and trying to infiltrate the minds of young people with nonsense that has been not only debased and bashed to pieces by practical experience in country after country that's tried to implement this, but even in their own romantic lecture halls where they imagine that the world could be better if we had this utopian ideal? None of these people who are proffering this as an option are the people who've had any practical experience in administration of any kind, right?
Well, you know, that's actually one of the interesting things. I think it's a self-selection problem. You know, I think people who are more capitalist inclined and more inclined to economic freedom tend to find productive things to do.
Yeah. Right?
And they don't end up staying in academia. You know, they go and they found companies and they start working for research organizations. They do productive things out in the economy. So they end up doing an honest day's work. Academics.
Which is also the reason why the worst people end up in politics, because for exactly the same reason that competent people are out there actually doing competent things.
Yes, indeed. They are out there busy making money and making their families more prosperous. And politicians are often the ones who stand on the sidelines, haven't been able to do that, and they feel that they are able to criticize from the sidelines. You know, and it's easy to demonize rich people, and that's what a lot of politicians do.
But
exactly what happens with the academics. The academics, the ones who can't make it out in the market, end up staying in academia. And certainly in the arts and humanities, the idea of testing against empirical data is fairly weak. There's a lot more theory, I think, than empiricism in the humanities.
There's an interesting piece of study that's been done recently on whether or not people actually are interested in, for example, taxing the very wealthy because they actually care about the poor, or whether it's just a direct byproduct of resentment, bitterness, and jealousy. And the research, I will find it so that I can give it a proper footnote at the end of this podcast, but basically it turns out that the reason that people are interested in taxing the very wealthy has nothing to do with them wanting to help the poor and everything to do with them wanting to exploit the rich because of their jealousy, bitterness, and resentment over them.
You know, and it doesn't even really make financial sense. I mean, you know, if you look at executive pay, for example, you know, people complain that this person and that person earns 30 million rand a year you know, whatever the case may be. Well, if you look at them, you know, they run billion-dollar companies. There are very, very, very few people in the world that can do that. If you look at the value that they add compared to someone who just works there, it's really significant. And their decisions can make or break a company. And they can break companies very, very quickly.
Just ask SARS. Just ask SARS when it comes to trying to get tax out of all the people who have left that could. I mean, if Elon Musk was still here, they would be sitting on a golden goose.
No, but if you take their money, if you take their pay, the executive pay, right, yeah. and you distribute it among the thousands of workers in a company, right, well, each of them is going to get, I don't know, $100 extra a month.
It's not going to make much difference.
It's really not going to make much difference. Well, then you've got a CEO who doesn't earn anything, and presumably is either going to move to somewhere where he does make money, or just isn't going to bother with his work. Why would he?
There's a particular drum that I keep beating on with regard to executive pay, which is that if you look at the marginal tax rate that executives end up paying, essentially for every 100 rand that executive is earning, that executive is taking home less than 60 rand. And about 44 rand of that directly goes into the fiscus, which ultimately ends up being able to pay for grants, and it ends up paying for mm-hmm. infrastructure and all of those things. And people who say that you need to cap executive pay actually completely miss the point that in terms of our current tax structure, the more you end up paying those people at the top end, the larger the amount of money that actually flows back into the fiscus to allow us to do all of that other stuff. And the absurdity of saying, no, pay, right now we currently have the highest paid executives earning 1,000 times more than the lowest paid workers, and that's absolutely wrong. But that lowest paid worker is not paying any taxes, is not contributing to the overall well-being of the country. Now, there's a different discussion around whether the taxation regime is fair, but the logic actually fails to grasp people completely.
So
that's the thing. It doesn't actually empirically, if you look at what taxing the rich will do, it really won't make that much difference, except that it will make a lot of the rich move to places where they aren't taxed as highly, where they actually can get paid what they're worth. It'll just contribute to a brain drain in this country. It already is.
It's interesting that, so many people think that the world that we live in now is still run by the old kind of rules of borders and sovereign states that we had in the 16, 17, and 1800s. Obviously now, if you are wealthy, there's a world that you can go into. There are places that you can go where you'll pay very, very little tax. And people who have lots of money will just do that. They'll up and go.
Now, a lot of people are doing exactly that.
And that's bad news. That's obviously bad news for the middle class, because then they end up footing the bill for the people that otherwise would have been able to make a contribution.
Exactly. I mean, our taxes keep rising, and SARS is struggling to collect money. And one of the reasons is that a lot of people at the top end of business are moving. They said, all right, well, we've kind of had enough of this country, and we're going to New Zealand or Australia somewhere where they actually feel that they have more security in terms of their wealth and prosperity.
I'd like to hear from both of you on something that I saw in the news last week and which irritated me a little bit. I'm sure it irritated a lot of people. Edward Kiesvetter, who's by all means a competent person at SARS, and he seems to be trying his best to stop us from worrying that a tax revolt is necessary, said the other day a very bizarre thing, and I can't help thinking it comes from the ANC's collective responsibility mantra. He said, we're all complicit in the situation that SARS finds itself in. And he meant everyone in the country, and I think it's okay for us to take serious umbrage to that, because for ordinary tax-paying citizens, that's not the case at all. They've carried on paying their taxes through thick and thin, no matter how much has been stolen, misappropriated, and thrown down a seemingly bottomless pit in places like Eskom. I don't think it's fair for him to say that we're all complicit in the situation that we find ourselves in now.
I think it's a grave insult. I think that is typically politicians not taking responsibility for their own actions and their own failures, and their own corruption. I mean, and you hear it from Ramaphosa and other politicians as well, saying, oh, we're all in this together. No, we're not. No, I didn't steal the money.
Now, hang on, guys. Wait a second. Are we actually saying that we are offended? Because I thought that's something that only happens on the other side of the fence.
Good point.
Well, if you're gonna call me a thief, and if you're gonna call me complicit in corruption, then absolutely I'm gonna get offended.
No, I'm actually gonna stop paying taxes.
Well, yeah, that's Canton's ultimate end goal in all of this.
Yeah, well, we can dream, can't we?
Yes, well, I think we're getting to the point now where the number of people who are employed in the formal sector, in other words, people where SARS has the ability to take your tax up front in the form of PAYE, that is the sector of the employment that is dropping at the quickest rate.
Mm.
And all of the employment that is actually being created is pretty much in the informal sector, where they're completely out of the tax net. And I think that's the pattern that we're going to continue seeing. One of the reasons why we've had a real decline in terms of that, you know, yes, there's the Laffer curve, but I don't think that's really applied in this case yet. It's just that so many people are actually moving their money out of the formal economic structures, and there's a lot of cash transactions taking place. There's lots of barter transactions taking place behind the scenes, and ultimately all of those things mean it's effectively tax revolt, because the money is not forming through passing through the formal banking sector anymore, which mm-hmm. means that SARS is not able to track it, but the money is certainly out there in terms of cash that's moving around. So I think that the tax revolt, Gareth, is actually happening, and it's real. It's just that people are not understanding the shape that it's taking.
Can we move on to some other issues? Let's start off with my money and the probe into his car and house allegations. This is such a non-story, but let's give it some oxygen. Do you think this is worth looking into? I mean, we're constantly talking about corruption in the ANC. Obviously, that's on a much, much bigger and much more deadly scale. But this is obviously embarrassing to the opposition party and the opposition leader. It seems that everyone in politics is beholden to someone who pays their bills. They're like children who don't seem to be able to manage their own finances. Am I being unfair, or is there something more to this
story?
Well,
my question is, why does he need a free car? Because every member of parliament gets a car allowance.
Yeah.
And why is he actually not spending the car allowance and acquiring a car instead of actually taking a freebie? It doesn't matter who the freebie comes from. It doesn't matter how well-intentioned it is. Unless he's telling us, well, I took a free car because I was then taking my car allowance and donating it to the party or donating it to my favorite charity. Well, you know, I'd actually cut him some slack at that point. But really, accepting a freebie, no matter how well-intentioned or poorly intentioned, there's no way that the optics ever end up looking good. No way.
Yeah. If you're a politician and you're campaigning to get elected, right, mm-hmm. I can understand that you might end up in this sort of compromising position, because you're reliant on donors one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you collect money from all your donors. And yes, then you're going to end up in a situation where things like your house and your car are going to end up getting paid for by your political donors. But once you have a position, right, and a very well-paid position at that, right, which Maimane does, you know, I'm not sure of exactly what his salary is, but I would imagine it's in the region of $1.5 million or so.
Yeah.
A year. And that's not counting the car allowances, the houses, the flight allowances, you know, what is it, 88 trips a year or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you add all of that, it probably goes up to about $6 or $8 million a year. Right? So why, in that case, would he need to take personal donations from anyone? That makes no sense to me.
This is why I say it's embarrassing, because it seems to me that, I mean, Julius is being funded by Mazzotti. You've got Cyril and his donors for his political campaign, and we know that, you know, he was put into business and he was the first big BEE guy. And it seems that all of these people need someone behind the scenes helping and shepherding them into a situation where they can manage their finances appropriately, because they seem completely unable. All the politicians, and here we've got the three leaders of the three major parties I mentioned, and there are many more of even lesser quality who also just they will take money from, it seems, wherever it can come, and they will do whatever they can to have someone else manage their finances. They're derelicts. I mean, is that the state of South African politics?
It doesn't go into their election campaigns.
No.
I mean, that's what bugs me. They've got more than enough money to manage their own private lives, right? Two houses, several cars, all of that they can pay from their own income, from their legitimate income. If they collect donations, well, absolutely fine. You're in an election campaign. You're trying to get elected. People need lots of money for that.
Yeah.
But then keep it within that election campaign and ring fence it and make sure it gets spent on campaigning, and not on your personal lifestyle.
Do you feel that it's any better anywhere else in the world? I'm thinking now of campaign finance violations in America, for example. They just found out that Elizabeth Warren's daughter redirected some funding to her rather than Bernie Sanders because she's on the board of some company in California or an NGO, as it may be. It seems to me that this is something that happens with politicians everywhere because they're actually not very good at generating money. They're not very good at making and understanding the basics of productivity.
Mike Schussler's got a good piece that he tweeted this morning, which I retweeted a short while ago, where he was actually looking, if you look at South Africa as a business, mm-hmm. and if you look in terms of what the return is on turnover of that particular business, we clock in at less than 6%.
Sure.
So in other words, if you took all of the money that South Africa was actually generating and just stuck it in a bank rather than allowing the government to continue to run the economy the way in which it does, you'd be significantly better off. But there's a range of things that actually come directly from this, because you get this constant banging on the drum about the fact that a number of companies are sitting on massive amounts of capital that hasn't been invested in the process of job creation. But if you were to take that same money and invest it in actually starting a business, and by the time you factor in the BEE tax, and by the time you factor in the strike days lost tax, and by the time you factor in the incompetence tax, and all of those things, you're significantly better off just taking the money, sticking it in the bank, and it's far safer.
Yeah. Can we talk about, it's not just politicians who are beholden. It seems that journalists also don't mind taking money. There are, however, new bits of information that seem to be coming up. Tiso Black Star journalist Ranjini Munsami has denied that she refused to cooperate with officials investigating her car settlement after this was alleged at the State Capture Commission of Inquiry. She's filed a second affidavit in response to the allegations. Her name was mentioned at the commission 2 weeks ago after it emerged that her car was allegedly paid off using funds from the Secret Service account. At the time, she was not working as a journalist. It's fair to say that. And she was suspended in 2003 by the Sunday Times for passing on a story to the City Press on then-National Director of Public Prosecutions, Bulelani Ngqoka. She resigned before disciplinary measures were instituted against her, and she then worked as a communications specialist and started the Friends of Jacob Zuma. So what do we make of, this, Ivo? I mean, you've been a journalist for a long time. Have you ever been offered by some, you know, low-level or high-level police person to pay off your car?
Again, I wish. You know, and I must say, I mean, I don't know exactly what the facts are behind Ranjani's car, but her story that she has a close family friend that gave up on buying his own car in order that he could pay off her car to the tune of 150,000 rand. I'm sorry, that just strikes me as a bit rich. I mean, who has family friends like that? You know, I certainly don't. So it raises a lot of questions, and I suspect that in her time that she worked as sort of a PR for Zuma, you know, I think that maybe she lost her moral compass there somewhat.
Well, I think by definition, as soon as you start working for Jacob Zuma, you've lost your moral compass.
Well, you have to, exactly.
I was taking a look. One of the things that came out from that hearing was the whole idea that her repairs were done on her car, and then she was unhappy with it, and they then had to change the tires and put on run flat tires instead of regular tires. And
so she's also looking a gift horse in the mouth.
Well, you know, the question is, what was the quid pro quo that was actually involved out there?
Well, that's the question. I mean, and for that matter, what is the quid pro quo from this family friend of hers? You know, this guy who apparently runs a grocery somewhere.
That's a very fair question.
Why would he pay off her car? Give up on buying his own Nissan Hardbody or whatever it was, because he couldn't afford that then. What did she do for him? Where was his quid pro quo? I mean, nobody does that for free. Mm. You know, there's a whole lot in the story that really I think still needs to come out, and it doesn't make sense to me.
Julius Malema, meanwhile, has rejected Helen Ziller's invitation to a no-holds-barred discussion on her podcast about the country's prospects. Are we surprised by this? I mean, Julius very seldom puts himself in a position where he's able to debate in a sensible situation.
He saw what happened to Max de Kreer, and he said, "I'm not doing that."
Yeah, I think probably a good decision on his part, but. You know, not for some people, I suppose it would be disappointing. I didn't expect much of a different result from this discussion. And poor Helen is going to find that there are going to be very few people who want to sit down with her, either because they just really despise her, or because they're not prepared to have the kinds of conversations she wants to have, because they're not on their terms. They like rhetoric. Well, they like
It's not just that. I think Helen is extremely good at that sort of thing. You know, to go into an adversarial debate with Helen Ziller, I mean, that would be my worst nightmare. She's got an extremely good memory. You know, she will take anyone to the cleaners in a live one-on-one debate. So I think that's probably what Malema fears. Even though Malema himself is a very, very good speaker and a very, very good debater. I mean, if you've ever seen him on stage, you know, he's a very impressive figure on a stage.
Certainly I would agree with you in terms of speaker and a rhetorician, but I wouldn't say he was a very good debater. I think that's a different set of factors and qualities that I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, he's kind of the Kamala Harris of South African politics, in the sense that a lot of the way in which he comes across to audiences is based on a very particular style and pattern in terms of how he delivers his stuff. He will, you know, look the audience in the eye, wind them up to the appropriate point, and then simply by changing the pitch of his voice, suddenly everyone says, "Yes, Julius is on point," and they start applauding. It's very formulaic. And I'm sure that someone's written a playbook in terms of how to actually get the crowds wound up that way. And Kamala Harris does exactly the same thing.
Yeah, she absolutely does.
I mean, I've seen him in front of business audiences, you know, at the gathering, the Daily Maverick sort of conference, and people are eating out of his hand, and you know, and I've seen the same thing with Zwelinzima Mavavi, for example, right? Uh-huh. You know, he'll go and speak to a business audience, and I keep trying to remind them. I said, "Don't you know that this guy is a communist? He wants to take your stuff. Why are you cheering him?"
Well, I say, "Don't you know this guy is a sexual predator? Look at his hiring practices."
All right. Yeah. We won't be casting any extra aspersions Zwelinzima Mavavi's way. It's interesting that you guys chose...
No, it's not an expert.
You chose to make him relevant again, where he's been mostly in the hinterland for the longest time.
Something that we do need to speak about that's actually quite important is the fact that the law that requires that unions now need to have secret ballots in order to do things like strike actions is now a thing. So in other words, it was buried in the amendments to the Labor Relations Act, which kicked in on the 1st of January.
Right.
But it was basically deferred until such time as the word could be gotten out to most of the unions. And as of the beginning of September, that now is the law. And what you have now is the unions threatening, the union bosses are now threatening to fight this all the way to the Constitutional Court, because they're claiming that it's anti-democratic to insist that there be secret ballots. But in fact, it's the absence of secret ballots that have allowed the union mafia to continue to exert the type of sway that they do. Because it means nothing to the head of a union to put the workers on strike for 6 months, because they're still drawing their salaries, you know, but for the workers, no work, no pay actually applies.
It hits them very hard.
Yeah. So
I don't know how they can call it undemocratic. I mean, the basic principle in any democratic dispensation is that your ballot is
absolutely
secret.
Absolutely, yes.
And there's very good reason for that. It's so that you cannot be intimidated. In fact, I posted my vote the other day for the elections. I posted that on Twitter, right? And I probably shouldn't admit this, because apparently I committed a criminal offense by doing so. Right?
Oh.
You cannot voluntarily disclose who you voted for.
Oh, wow.
Right? And that is also because someone might have actually forced me to do so in order to intimidate me and get me to vote a certain way.
I wasn't aware of that.
The idea
that your ballot is secret is fundamental in a democracy, and to make sure that people vote the way that their consciences, that their conscience leads them. And I don't see why this should be different in union elections. In fact, I think it's key in union elections. Keep the vote secret. Make sure that the workers actually have the freedom to vote the way that they really feel, rather than the way that they feel the majority or the union bosses want them to vote.
Well, in many cases, if they, by show of hands, they vote the wrong way, they immediately get flagged as troublemakers and rabble-rousers, and very quickly could see themselves either out of a job or dead or both.
Yeah, no, indeed. And I think that's one of the problems with unions. In a free market philosophy, unions have an absolute right to exist, and workers have a right to organize. They have a right to collective bargaining, etc. They're absolutely free to do so. But unions have excessive power in many ways. And one of them is that their ballots aren't secret, so they're able to intimidate workers. That's one of the key issues. Another one is that strikes are often too well protected by government, so that employers can't call their bluff. Employers don't have the freedom that workers do in a strike situation.
Well, that's one reason why the banking strike is unlikely to now go forward. Because the banking strike was basically deferred because the Labour Court found that the strike ballot that they had put together was based on a very arbitrary one that COSATU had tabled in 2017.
Oh, right.
And so it didn't relate specifically to a strike that needed to happen now. What happened in 2017 was that COSATU failed to reach agreement in terms of retrenchments at the point around the economic downturn. And at that time, they basically declared with NEDLAC that they had a deadlock. They tried to use that declaration to NEDLAC in 2017 as the basis for a subsidiary union, which is SASBO, going on strike this time around. And, of course, COSATU wanted a sympathy strike. And the Labour Court said, no, actually, you need to go through the process. But what it now means is that the process has to involve secret ballots across all of the unions that want to join the strike action. And if you ask yourself whether something like 40 to 70,000 workers in the banking sector who are part of these unions would want to actually end up losing several days' worth of pay in order to satisfy some vague protest against the economy, I think it's highly unlikely.
Yeah, they'll probably say no. But then, you know, let's be fair. These unions have for the longest time been taking advantage of poor people and of people who they're supposed to be protecting to enrich themselves. I mean, the unions have some of the biggest investment accounts in the country, right? These are people who are not by any means poor.
Yeah, and I mean, that also goes to the sort of freedom and the powers that unions have. You know, the whole closed shop arrangement that people are forced to be members of unions if a majority of workers in that shop are. Or the other arrangement they've got is the agency shop, where you're not forced to be a member, but you do have to pay dues on the basis that, well, you know, the union, if the union negotiates an increased salary, then everyone benefits, and therefore everyone ought to pay union dues. So you don't really have a choice.
Yeah, you don't, there's no option.
There's no option whether you want to pay your dues to a union, whether you want to be a member of the union. Workers get forced into it, and that gives unions incredible power and incredible money, incredible wealth.
Let's just talk also about the former SARS commissioner, Tom Moyani, who on Wednesday was expected to launch a fresh application to cross-examine Public Enterprises Minister Pravin Gordhan. And Dalim Pofu, obviously his counsel, was remonstrative in the commission yesterday from the point of view of his client not being able to stand up for himself and have his say. It seems to me that they're trying to get Pravin back in there. When Pravin said all he has to say, what do you think's really going on here? Nobody. Nobody wants to have
look,
a go.
I think the Pravin narrative right now, if you look in terms of all of the EFF bots, they've been pushing the Pravin line quite substantially for a while. I don't see the point at which this is actually going to ever go away. because it's fundamentally driven by an undercurrent of racism, because it goes back to the whole narrative that gets pushed by the AFF around the idea of an Indian cabal, mm-hmm. and all of that sort of terminology that keeps popping up. And it's a distraction, because it allows you to not focus on things like VBS. It allows you to not focus on the massive amounts of money that were looted in so many other directions. And instead creates this idea that you've got Praveen, who is apparently a defender of white monopoly capital. And I'd be really interested to see exactly who the people are that he's purportedly defending, because I haven't seen any evidence of it thus far. But should Moyane have the right to question Praveen? I think yes, because it makes for at least slightly less boring television, because we'll have something to talk about for a couple of days.
Yeah, but I think you're right in that the motive there is very suspect. I mean, obviously Moyane is probably trying to defend his own reputation, although how he could recover his reputation, I'm not sure. But he's trying to damage Praveen Gordhan and embarrass Praveen Gordhan and. You know, very often, you know, with stories like that, they, you know, it breaks in the news. It says, oh, you know, Moyane alleges this, right? And then the EFF will run with it, and the opponents of the Zuma camp will run with it. And by the time things are cleared up, you know, it becomes a story on page 3 or page 5.
Yeah.
So the damage in the public perception has been done. And I think so it's the process of undermining Praveen Gordhan and undermining the very weak sort of campaign against corruption in the government.
Can I turn our attention just further afield to America at the moment? Seems the Dems have finally launched their impeachment proceedings, or at least the impeachment inquiry. Where does this go? Do either of you have any predictions on what's going to happen as a result of this new attempt to get rid of Donald Trump?
I got a call from a friend of mine in Seattle, who's he's a tech entrepreneur. He's quite wealthy, mm-hmm. but he and I worked at Princeton together and had many small hours of the morning coding and playing arcade games and all of that kind of stuff. And he calls and he says, can you give me some real politic advice in terms of what's happening right now? I said, well, you know, you've probably seen the transcript of what Trump was up to. It was a classic mob shakedown. Hey, you scratch my back, I scratch yours.
You'd expect then, it from The Sopranos.
Exactly. But the follow-up question is that in order to have an impeachment, well, the first thing that needs to happen is that the House has to call for impeachment. So tick that box. Yes, that's going to happen. But then the Senate has to hear the impeachment. Now, you have a Republican majority in Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And moreover, in order for the impeachment to actually pass, it has to be passed by a 2/3 majority.
Yes.
And what are the chances of the Republicans ever passing an impeachment against a president who, by their own polling, is the most popular president they've ever had? I think it's highly unlikely to ever happen.
So it's stillborn.
It's completely stillborn. This stuff is...
No flex chance in hell.
Yeah.
So why, look, why are they so hell-bent on it?
I suspect that Pelosi was sort of pushed into a corner by the sort of more left-wing Democrats who desperately wanted an impeachment. Strategically, and I've been saying this for quite a while now, is what they ought to do is hold this impeachment process, mm-hmm. right, until next year, until four or five months before the election. So they can have because the impeachment process takes about 3 months, right? And it needs to be heard first in Congress and then in the Senate, needs to have a trial and so on. Now, it's not going to succeed, right? But if you can keep Donald Trump off the campaign trail for 3 months,
yeah.
right, in the lead up to next year's election, right, that might actually dent his chances of being reelected, right? So it would be purely a strategic thing.
Okay.
And that's what I thought the Democrats should do strategically. The fact that they're forcing it now, I think it's too early. I think it's not going to distract Trump from his campaign next year, from his election, re-election campaign. I think it'll certainly harden and whip up his base, right? Because now he's a, you know, he's a popular leader and he's under fire from all these left-wing Democrats. So I reckon he's actually going to come out of this stronger because, as Kanthan says, the chances that the Senate are actually going to impeach him, are actually going to find him guilty, are pretty much zero.
And the follow-up point is, do you guys know how many presidents have actually been impeached in the course of American history?
Isn't it two?
I think it's two or three.
No, there were proceedings that were brought, but the number
none of them have been found guilty in the Senate.
Yes, none of them were actually impeached. And the one who came closest was Nixon, but he resigned before he could be impeached.
Because, he resigned before he could be impeached. Yes. Clinton was impeached.
Yes.
Because impeachment is the process in Congress.
Correct, yes. But it wasn't passed.
Impeachment is the process whereby Congress instructs the Senate to conduct a trial.
Yes.
Now, that is what happened to Clinton. And Congress indeed did instruct the Senate to conduct a trial, and the Senate then threw it out.
Right.
So the Senate never convicted Clinton. But he was impeached, and I think there was one or two more, but quite a long time ago. I can't remember who they were.
Johnson and I think the other one would have been Nixon.
But again, they were never removed from office.
No.
By the Senate.
But of course, the other reason for raising this at this point, we mustn't forget this, is that it does become a useful distraction around the fact that Biden lied. Because Biden said he had no idea about his son's dealings with the Ukrainian oligarchs. And instead, Trump posts a picture of Biden and said Ukrainian oligarch and Biden's son, you know, all posing very happily for the camera. So, so right now, given that Biden, in spite of all of the lobbying behind the scene for Elizabeth Warren, Biden is still the most likely candidate at this point from the...
Don't you think this has ruined his chances?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I think that the impeachment proceedings allow them to not talk about whether there actually was any corruption involved in terms of his son's dealings with the Ukraine.
Mm, okay.
So, yeah, it's another wag the dog scenario.
I think they will end up talking about that, and I think that Biden, one way or another, is probably done. And I think that might also be part of the strategy. I think that might be why the left wing of the Democratic Party, who see Biden as a centrist of the old guard,
yes,
I think they might have been pushing for the impeachment, in part to maybe neutralize Biden. And increase their own chances.
It's kind of not dissimilar to what's going on with the Democratic Alliance right now, which is, you know, the whole idea of let's put forward the white man who has the biggest chance of reuniting the party. And the rest of them saying, no, that'll be going backwards.
As far as I understand, the IRR said that, not the DA.
Well,
I'm generally very supportive of the IRR.
Yes.
But when I saw that tweet about the white man in Cape Town who holds the answer for the DA, I thought, what on earth are they doing? Why does it matter that he's white? I mean, you know, I like Alan Winder as much as the next guy, but surely his race has nothing to do with this.
Yes, it was a very poorly framed argument, right up until the point. Look, everything that I think it was Herman Pretorius who wrote the piece. I forget. I was in agreement with just about everything until finally he says, "Well, but you know, the main reason why we should is because the guy's white." So what?
That's ridiculous. But you see, identity politics has poisoned the well, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh. This is the problem.
Identity politics is an evil thing, you know, and it becomes so corrupting because you always see if one side plays identity politics, and the left certainly does, you know, they absolutely play identity politics. The whole notion of, you know, being called a racist. I mean, I was called a racist the other day, a white supremacist the other day, simply on the grounds that A, I'm white, and B, I support capitalism.
Yeah.
That was the totality of the argument.
But don't lie, Ivo. We all know you are.
What a white supremacist.
No, it's not.
All right. Oh, my goodness.
But you see, it, 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 it poisons the entire debate, because what you get is you get people become defensive about the fact that they're white.
Yeah.
And they start saying, well, actually, you know, yeah, I'm white and I'm proud of it. And so you generate a sense of racism and racial nationalism.
Yeah.
Simply by playing identity politics in the first place. That to me is a very worrying trend in this country, and I see that a lot on the right wing, that people tend to become racist simply as a reaction to what they feel is the identity politics played by the ANC and the EFF.
Well, I suppose that can also be said, and to go back to where we started in this discussion today, that can be true for environmental stuff too. You know, when Greta Thunberg gets up at the UN and starts telling us, how dare you, and it's not that she's wrong or that I'm offended by a young girl who's really passionate about what she's there to say. It's that the people that are heralding her as some kind of new messiah are exactly the people I like to piss off. And as a result, I go out of my way to make fun of her and environmental issues and side with the climate deniers just to piss them off. I don't actually believe in those things. I'm not actually offended by Greta Thunberg. I'm just in a position where I like to piss off the people who elevate a child like that to a position of importance.
Well, guess what? Our dreams do get stolen. Okay, when I was her age, I was told that there was going to be this future when we're going to be having space travel, we're going to be having flying cars all around the place, and we would have robot servants that would be popping up and serving us cocktails at sundown, and none of that stuff has come to pass. They stole my dreams, and I did not get to stand up at the United Nations. My goodness.
You know, As I wrote in my column this week, I said, you know, I did it. You know, all the generations of teenagers have done what she did. You know, stamp her feet and yell at the adults. I mean, we all did it. The punks did it. The hippies did it. And then we all grew up. You know, but it's an interesting strategy from the environmental movement, because you know, I mentioned something about Greta Thunberg on Twitter, and I immediately got a response back, a meme about my fragile white masculinity something.
No, no, I saw some of those too. Like, it's just such an obvious and predictable reaction.
And I wasn't even being mean. You know, I've said nothing about the fact that she's got Asperger's or anxiety or depression or whatever, that she might not be mentally capable of taking this on, or that she's being handled by anyone. I said nothing like that. I directly challenged the substance of what she said. But if you do that, you get automatically denounced as a bully or a sexist or some other brand of bigot. So it insulates that message that she gives from criticism of all sorts. It's a genius strategy on the part of the Greens.
Of course, but why else use children? You know, this is the thing exactly. That no one wants to talk about. Everybody says it's very abusive of us to disagree with her. But it's quite abusive to put her up there on that stage and make her do this.
Children are always the thin edge of the wedge that I use to put in place any repressive legislation. So any attempt, for example, to clamp down on free speech always starts with, we need to protect the children.
Yeah.
It becomes really difficult from an emotional point of view for people to start arguing, well, actually, the principle is far more important than you're not taking responsibility for protecting your particular child from the effects of whatever it is that we are trying to block at this point.
Yeah.
And you see this translated at so many levels. We need to protect the environment because of our children. We need to stamp out free speech because of our children. We need to reduce speed limits because of our children.
And you see that on the political side as well. I mean, you know, if you look at all the campaigning about poverty in Africa, you know, it's always some child on the photograph, you know, with flies on their lips and whatnot.
Poverty porn. Think of
the poor children, and that's why we need socialism.
Actually, the amazing thing was that actually the most nuanced response to Greta Thunberg that I've seen actually came from Putin.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, he had a very well-considered response. And he said, you know, I'm sure she means well, and but in fact there are realities in the world that have not actually been taught to her. And, you know, part of that reality is that you need development, particularly in poorer countries, in order for people to actually be able to raise themselves out of poverty. And these are all things that are absolutely accurate. And the whole idea, for example, that if we suddenly ripped out all of our coal-fired plants in this country and replaced them with solar, we wouldn't be able to run any smelters if we happen to suddenly become reliant on using solar energy. If we wanted to put in efficient high-speed rail networks, which, yes, I could dream. Again, this is one of my dreams that was stolen from me. But if you want to put in an efficient high-speed rail network, again, you're not going to be able to run that off solar or off wind. The only way you're going to be able to get to that is either by nuclear or by coal. And right now, it just turns out that we happen to be using coal. I prefer that we were using nuclear, frankly. But certainly we need to recognize that electricity, even from coal right now, is the single biggest thing that's uplifting people out of poverty on this continent. Because you used to have people actually dying of smoke inhalation. Because of the fact that they had wood fires inside their huts. And then you have fires that break out in shacks.
They still do. They still do. I wrote a report about that a couple of years ago for the IRR, about indoor air pollution. And indoor air pollution kills more people in this country than outdoor air pollution.
Wow.
And it's still because people actually burn coal and wood and dung inside their houses, and they cook on that. Electrification and with cheap electricity is absolutely saving lives, and it does, and that's what people forget, you know. And it's the same with Thunberg. She says, all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of economic growth. I said, well, sure, but that's because, you know, one day when you're old enough, right, you will understand, just like I discovered in this column, that higher per capita GDP and greater economic freedom actually improves environmental outcomes. So if you want to solve the world's environmental problems, focus on helping poor countries to become rich.
There we go.
Reduce the size of their government, lower barriers to trade, protect property rights, print less money, cut back on onerous regulations. All of that is what ultimately will end up giving people the motives to improve environmental outcomes.
Ivo, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much. Canton, thank you very much. And thank you for joining us on The Burning Platform this week. It's brought to you by Nando's, and we will check in with you again next week, Thursday, same time, same place. CliffCentral.com